All right, so I figured I couldn't quite live up to Nate, but I would try. This is the outline of my talk. See, it wasn't as good as Nate. So I'm going to start by talking about some very general models, a style of theory that I find very cool in biophysics. Then I will talk about some other styles and layers of modeling in biophysics. At various points, I will give you my own work, but I want to give a flavor of the full range of styles of things that people do in theoretical biophysics rather than just give you my own technical talk, since one of our themes is different ways that we do research in our institutions. I'm not necessarily aiming specifically at things done by PUI folks, just things that are done. Biophysics is still, I think, a relatively immature field in terms of its integration into physics departments. If you go to the APS March meeting, you will see a lot of biophysics talks done by people who are usually in physics departments and usually come from condensed matter backgrounds. And some of that work is great, and some of it is simply taking a well-known model and mapping it onto something that sounds biological, and a lot of it is everywhere in between. Like any other branch of science, any other discipline, you find ranges of applicability. If you go to a biophysical society meeting, you find, I would say, the same range of quality like in any other discipline, but you find that very few of the people are housed in a department of physics. They're mostly housed in a chemistry department for, I think, a lot of historical reasons and the fact that biochemistry is a very mature discipline. It's a very mature and natural integration of physical and life sciences. So what I'm showing you today is really not so much things that are done in PUIs, because a lot of this isn't yet done in PUIs. Yes, there are theoretical biophysicists at PUIs, but not as many as there are high energy, condensed matter, and so forth. So I'll talk about every range, from the most general fundamental limit models to the most reductionist models, models of a single process that fits somewhere in between. And then what I'm going to call models of experiments rather than phenomenology, because it's more than just phenomenology. It's often looking at fundamental physical questions just from a different angle, thinking, what are the actual observables that we could compute? And that, you might say, well, that's all of physics, theoretical physics, right? Isn't that you're always trying to compute an observable? But it's about computing the sorts of observables that are most natural to these messy, fluctuating environments. So with an 8-year lag, this is how I got into biophysics. This is the first science paper that I read from start to finish. The first, and it was a theory paper at that, and I actually went through every line of every derivation, and this should have been a hint to me, but it took me 8 years to figure out that maybe I should do biophysics. And this is called the West-Brown-Enquist model. And what has been known for more than a century, although contested by statisticians at the lower end, is that if you make a plot of average resting metabolic rate of an organism on the vertical scale and the average mass of that species on the horizontal scale, they fit a very nice 3/4 power law. There is a 3/4 relationship between metabolic rate and body mass. And this is averaging mature mammals. I don't know how much has been done on cold-blooded animals. We're talking healthy animals for the most part. You can always find your exceptions. And there's a lot of contest down here. But this was a puzzle. Because if you just think about what is it that the body actually does, all right? The body takes in food. What do we do with that food? Well, we convert some of it to work. But honestly, we spend like half our lives asleep, and a lot of mammals spend much of their time really not moving very fast. I mean, lions sleep like 23 and a half hours a day on those documentaries. Their prey, herbivores, mostly meander. They're not burning a lot of calories on locomotion, except when the lion pounces and then they run. So mammals spend most of their time not doing a whole lot of work. All right. So what do they do with that? Well, they take in food. They can use some of that energy for synthesis, converting food into some other chemical species that the body needs is certainly energy intensive. And the rest of that energy we use trying not to freeze to death. That's basically what we do. I mean, think about it. We are adapted to live everywhere from the Arctic to the tropics, yet no matter where you go, we and most of our mammalian cousins have core temperatures around 98, 100 degrees Fahrenheit. Humans, it's very tightly constrained at 98 point something Fahrenheit. Other mammals within a few degrees of that. So we spend most of our energy trying not to freeze to death. So if you think about that, that we spend most of our energy trying not to freeze to death, then our metabolic rate should really just depend on what does it take to not freeze to death. And our heat loss can only come from our exterior surface. Yes, we can perspire, dogs can exhale, and other mammals have other mechanisms for losing heat during bursts of activity, but most of it is going to be through our skin. And surface area is going to be proportional to the 2/3 power of mass, because essentially all mammals have very close to the same density. So you would expect a 2/3 power law. All right, that's what anyone would expect. And this is a big mystery for a long time. When this was first noted in the 19th century, people wondered about it. There was a lot of controversy. And in 1997, West, Brown, and Enquist came up with a model that isn't perfect, but gets us a lot of the way there. They have three assumptions in their model. The first, based on the experimental data on the right, is that there is a branching network of blood vessels, and that's a well-supported assumption. The second is that this network has the same terminal unit. That means that whether you're a blue whale with a huge aorta that's probably close to a meter in diameter, although I have to check that, or a tree shrew with a few millimeters in diameter, it'll branch down and branch down and branch down to something that's roughly 10 microns in diameter. And the reason for that is that red blood cells are essentially the same in all mammals. To a physicist, they're the same. They're all spherical cows. To a biologist, they'll start saying, no, this receptor on the surface is totally different. But to a physicist, they're the same size. They carry oxygen. So your smallest unit can't be any smaller than that. And furthermore, the density of terminal units is invariant because oxygen diffuses roughly 100 microns before it gets degraded in mammalian tissue. I mean, there's going to be difference in different tissue types and your metabolic state and all that, but roughly 100 microns. So you have these invariant terminal units, different starting units, invariant terminal units. And then the final thing that West, Brown, and Enquist assumed was that these organisms are designed not to match their environment, but not to match the loss rate, but rather to minimize energy dissipation, to make this cardiovascular system as efficient as possible. And that assumption goes back to Darwin, survival of the fittest. So presumably a cardiovascular system that consumes the least energy will be the most favorable. And when they make these assumptions, they can, I'm not going to go through all the mathematics of it, but they can derive formulas for a network of tubes that gives exactly that relationship between metabolic rate and body mass. And there are some caveats. The three-fourths power law is strictly most accurate for large mammals. For smaller mammals, there are problems. Some of it has to do with the transition between different flow regimes in the blood vessels. Some of it has to do with the fact that heat loss does matter. People have worked on that, but this is still a good asymptotic model. And what really, you had a question? It's a good asymptotic model. The model published in 2010 by Colocktrones, or whatever, I can't remember the name exactly, at UCLA, basically still has the West, Brown, and Enquist model as its asymptotic limit. You were going to ask.
Well, so this 3/4 scaling law for heat loss, right? And
as you said, not for metabolic rate, not for heat loss. 2/3 for heat loss.
2/3 for heat loss, okay. Because I was going to say that doesn't matter then. I was going to talk about that the heat loss we perspire.
Yeah.
And that's how we cool off. But your dog breathes, right? So they don't sweat, right? And I don't know if that changes any of these scaling laws about how different mammals, but this is metabolic that you're talking about, so.
So it comes down to a question of, you're right, the heat loss rate is not the only area where metabolism goes, but it's one of the big three. Your big three are activity, heat loss, and synthesis. All right, chemical synthesis. Those are the three main things that you do with your energy inputs. And so the argument here is that rather than optimizing for one particular use of energy, heat loss, which we're not even really optimizing for, just acting under that constraint, really optimizing for delivery, and assuming that there are, because there are going to be different periods of activity, you are going to have different rates of heat loss depending on whether you're exercising or sleeping, whether it's day or night. And so what you should really optimize for is nutrient delivery, all right? Or delivery through this system of pipes, oxygen delivery and nutrient delivery. Remember that some of the most important things, so here's an angle to think about. Some of the most important work done by the blood vessels network is done in an embryo, right? And the less work that's required to pump that through the embryo, just to create the organism in the first place, the faster that pregnancy can be, right? And since our mammalian, I mean, this is, it's important to not think about these things solely in human terms. We can look at humans and say, well, we're social creatures, we have support networks. You have to think 100 million years ago, the first mammals, they need to optimize transport through that developing organism to get it to develop as fast as possible with as few metabolic requirements as possible. Every subsequent mammal faces the same constraint. So there, heat loss, and the reason why I'm harping on the embryos, because heat loss is not an issue there. It's in a thermal bath, all right? It is surrounded by its mother, so it's surrounded by water at 98 degrees. If you're surrounded by water at 98 degrees, you don't have to worry about heat loss. You're at the same temperature as your environment. But this network will still provide optimal transport during that crucial stage. Yeah?
And so my guess is that the more accurate models are going to change some of the some of those assumptions, but that last piece, is there sort of a sense of optimality that
The more accurate models only change this. They change our assumptions about energy dissipation in the different layers of the network and the different flow regimes. Yeah?
Alex, is there a similar graph for reptiles?
I should know that, but I don't. You look through this literature, and at least in the physics community, they always look at mammals. My guess is that there really should be, just because reptiles, you know, I've just argued here that nutrient delivery is what matters, not thermal regulation. So my intuition is that something similar should hold true for reptiles, but possibly with a different prefactor. Other questions? All right. Now, this is not the first time that physicists took a very large-scale view of biological questions and tried to derive general relationships. Purcell's famous talk on life at low Reynolds number, which got turned into an AGP article that's basically a transcript of his lecture, is still a big picture view. It's small length scale, but big picture. He just asked a very simple question about swimming. How do small organisms at low Reynolds number swim? And he goes through a very simple argument that cyclic motion like this, where you move and then you restore to the original state, cannot produce swimming, but rotational motion can, and so he derives the existence of flagella from pure reasoning, because he has a no-go theorem on swimming with deformation rather than rotation. And there have been other fundamental works like this. This is a beautiful one. This was worked on in 2002, and I saw this talk at the 2006 March meeting at a workshop for people transitioning into biophysics. They just started with the relationship between conduction velocity and wire diameter, and then made some assumptions about what an optimal network of wires would have. Minimal delays, maximum number of connections, minimum wire length, so you need as few raw materials as possible. And they worked out that the brain should be 60% wire. And then they dissected a mouse, looked at a few different parts of the brain, and sure enough, mice are 60% wire. I assume that someone has dissected the brain of a higher primate and estimated that, but I don't know for sure, but I'm assuming that. Sometimes I wonder how many human brains really are optimized, but that's another story. And there are a lot of fundamental results like this in biophysics. At one point, I was keeping a bibliography of papers like this. You can work out an optimal ratio of macromolecules to small molecules. Macromolecules are important because they do stuff, but they also exclude volume for small molecules to diffuse. And so you can make some assumptions about the network inside of the cell. And I think this is more applicable to bacteria because they don't have as many opportunities to take advantage of different compartments and folds. So you can work out what's an optimal composition for a bacterial cell. And sure enough, real bacteria, or at least E. coli, which even for biologists are the only bacteria that exist sometimes, obey that. You can work out that gradients of morphogens, which biophysicists studying development worry about a lot, can be optimized against noise. You can work out limits to concentration sensing. That's an ongoing literature. It goes back to Berg and Purcell. A few years ago in PRL, someone even published a finding that there is an optimal leaf size for tall trees. And there are many, many more like this. And I love this view from 50,000 feet style of biophysics because you really do get to have the spherical cowl. You can derive a limit that you know will apply to almost any bacteria, to almost any mammal, to almost any flying organism, whatever it may be. It's a style of biophysics that's a lot of fun, it's inspirational, and I wish that I had started in the field as soon as I read that paper. But sometimes you do have to zoom in. And a lot of day-to-day biophysics is done at the zoomed-in level. And to be honest, you cannot derive models like West-Brown-Enquist if you never zoom in, because you'll never even figure out what question to ask unless you zoom in. So physicists span a wide range of length scales in the systems that they study. You will find people using quantum mechanics in biophysics when they're looking at electron transfer. Then you get to longer length scales. There are lots of molecular modelers. As soon as you start thinking about molecular crowding and interactions, you're on one longer length scale. You get a lot of soft materials techniques in membranes and cytoskeletons. Then you get to large scale, anything that's more than one cell, and now you can talk about physiology, biomechanics, fluid mechanics. A lot of this is actually amenable to reaction diffusion models or random walk models, which can be quite mathematically sophisticated. JJ showed some of that yesterday, but are still in a language that's approachable to a sophomore. You don't have to first learn renormalization group techniques. You don't have to first learn what non-commuting operators are. If you learn sophomore differential equations, you can jump into this. So there's a very wide range of styles of theory. I'll give you one other style. This is one of the first things I worked on when I got into biophysics, and it was partly one of the things that drew me to this project from the menu in front of me was that it's related to blood vessels. Turns out that tumors are very greedy little bastards. I just told you that your body is optimized to deliver nutrients to tissue at every stage of development. Well, your body has mechanisms for regenerating blood vessels. You use this when a wound is healed. You use this when you grow from being a little baby to much taller, and throughout there you acquire some new blood vessels. Every time some tissue is starved of oxygen, it sends out a molecule called vascular endothelial growth factor, VEGF, and biology is nothing if not acronyms. Except that whereas the government likes three-letter acronyms, biologists often like four. And VEGF basically sends a message to capillaries saying, grow a new sprout. This is how networks expand. Well, tumors hijack that because they're growing faster than the surrounding tissue. If they were growing at the same rate as the surrounding tissue, they wouldn't be tumors. So because they're growing faster than the surrounding tissue, they send out a signal saying, hey, we need more oxygen here. Can someone grow us a capillary? And the body does what the body is supposed to do. It grows a new capillary. And this is a target for therapeutic interventions. It has been for decades. There have been some successes. And about 10 years ago, it was a very hot area for people doing mathematical modeling in biology. It got a lot of attention because NIH was paying more attention to it, and they were looking for mathematical modelers, and I was working at NIH. And so there's this whole process where the VEGF has to diffuse through the tissue. It interacts with the extracellular matrix. It can bind to the extracellular matrix, which is a network of fibers standing between the tumor and the blood vessel. It can be removed from the matrix by the action of different molecules. And so we did a reaction diffusion model of that to try to explain why it is that different forms of VEGF give rise to blood vessel networks with very different appearances. And we were able to relate that to the shape of the concentration profiles that form in tissue when you have different assumptions for the kinetics of binding and for the presence or absence of other molecules that interact with that process. And then we were able to show that if we work with those concentration profiles and the spatial signals that they encode, and we just ask, well, how about a biased random walk? One of the simplest stochastic models you could make, what happens when you have different degrees of spatial signaling? And what I'm plotting here is the contour length of the random walk that starts at the capillary and ends at the tumor, the average and the standard deviation for different types of concentration profiles. And what you find is that for one set of conditions, one set of assumptions about the kinetics, low variability and a contour length that is almost independent of details. For the other one, you get high variability and an average contour length that depends strongly on details, which is exactly what you see for these different pictures of things that go more or less in one direction versus things that are meandering all over the place.
Question?
Yeah.
Is it easy to understand
or to put in terms that we can understand how VEGF 189 and 113 and so forth differ from each other?
They differ in their in how strongly they bind to basically the network of fibers sitting between the tumor and the blood vessel.
And are they all basically variations on the same basic chemical with some little...
They all have the same part that can bind to the capillary, all right? So you could think of this molecule oversimplified as having two ends. One end will attach to something on the capillary and tell the capillary, grow. The other end will attach to these. If they bind very strongly to these, then you don't get much of a concentration gradient. You get a matrix that's saturated, all right, with VEGF. So there's no directional signal. There's a little bit of a directional signal modulated by this other molecule, which can be produced in different locations and cleave some of it from the matrix. So it could remove VEGF from here and leave VEGF there. which could give you something of a directional signal. But how smooth that signal is going to depend on where these sources are placed in the kinetics of binding there. Yes, Fred.
And so then, you know, the biased random walk type model, is there then sort of a mapping to, or it, could one understand those two different plots by mapping to something like, you know, the diffusion constant, the biasing factor, and, you know, maybe viscosity or something like that? Or is it actually more microscopically based?
I wouldn't use a diffusion model because you don't usually have a very dense network of cells. I just think of it as, I would basically think of this as a one-parameter random walk. I would assume that the, two parameters. I would assume a step size equal to a cell size because they grow one at a time. And then I would assume some distribution of step directions that's uniform in the, when the gradient of concentration is zero, and then gets biased as the concentration gradient gets larger. So there'd be one coefficient in there. And so you don't actually have to map the VEGF onto that random walk model. The random walk model just depends on how the cell responds to the VEGF. And then the concentration gradient is the environment that the random walk takes place in. I'll go through a little more of a breakdown of who does what in biophysics. All the stuff I showed you on fundamental limits is primarily done by physicists. Membrane cytoskeletons, ordering, things that sound like condensed matter physics or biomechanics, again, by physicists. When you get into reaction diffusion models, you start to see more mathematicians, especially long chains of reactions. My own completely biased opinion as a physicist is that the physicists are better at this because the mathematicians put in too many parameters. The physicists are more likely to seek an emergent behavior, an emergent model. We're more likely to try to reduce the number of parameters. Biologists, and what I'm about to say is not a criticism of a biologist. It sounds like a criticism only if you have not really thought about the task in front of them. Biologists think about many, many, many parameters and do not reduce the number of variables unless pushed. And that can sound like a bad thing to a physicist because we're used to thinking, oh my God, what idiot would make a model with 1,000 parameters? I'll tell you who would make a model with 1,000 parameters. Someone who actually knows that different cell lines can produce completely different results. Someone who actually knows that one small perturbation of the experimental conditions really can produce different results. So they think about a lot of parameters for a very good reason. And the mathematicians tend to slot into that naturally. But while they have a good reason for what they do, they also miss certain things. Just like physicists, we have a very good reason for seeking emergent models with as few parameters as possible. That's our strength. It's also sometimes our weakness when we try to collaborate with a biologist. They're like, well, I just want this one parameter. And they have to sit me down for a while and say, no, no, no. We've got five different cell lines here, and they don't all show the same behavior, and there's a good reason for worrying about these differences. Yes?
Just to I guess, push on that point a little more. So, you know, sometimes people hear life is sitting at some border between order and chaos.
Yeah.
And then these fundamental limits, it sounds like that's sort of looking at some sort of optimum principle or some equilibrium principle. And so I'm wondering, is there, in these different models, are there different concepts that are more primary sort of at the one end versus the other end?
Fundamental limits tend to pay attention to what has to happen when something is working, although people also work out robustness. I mean, a lot of the times, a fundamental limit actually is a sign of robustness. If you can minimize the energy dissipation in your network, then you are robust against a year with fewer crops. You are robust against the decline in prey populations. if you can work out a design that senses small, that can sense the smallest possible concentration gradients, you're still going to want to go to areas with larger concentration gradients. You love to hang out there, but you are robust against situations that force you to the low end. So I don't know that I have an easy answer for this. A lot of these optimized things are implicitly robust. And then, although I didn't show this, there are people who have worked on explicit questions of robustness of signaling networks against noise. Other questions? I'm going to skim through the next part in the interests of time, but there is a layer of reductionism that gets a lot of attention as theory in biology, and that is molecular modeling. And a lot of it is done by chemists, some of it for the obvious reason that a physicist would look at a protein with 600 atoms and say that there are 599 too many atoms in there. We like our hydrogen atoms. So that's part of why this part of the field tends to have a lot more chemists than physicists. They're comfortable with bonding. We aren't. Part of it is history. There was an influx of physicists into biology shortly after World War II, especially into molecular biology. And for a lot of reasons, some of them that may just be the necessities of the work, some of them may be the narrowness of the physics community, some of them chance, they did not do their work on physics department letterhead. They did not sit in buildings with physics on the sign outside. And so they got assimilated into the chemistry community. And even though we can look at a lot of heroes like Max Delbruck, Francis Crick, who had physics backgrounds, they trained students from biology and chemistry programs and went native. And when you go to Biophysical Society today, you still see far more chemists than physicists. But this is a mode that, with the right mentoring, is very amenable to undergraduate participation. There is canned and standardized code in the good way, not the bad way. Canned things can be very bad if they lead to monoculture assumptions or treating everything like a nail because all you have is this one canned hammer. But there are things that have been vetted over decades, and undergrads can run them and acquire intuition. So I have a few slides that I'll skim through from Paul Nirenberg, who was at the Claremont Colleges, then did a stint at Caltech as a research scientist, and because he was a visiting assistant at the Claremont Colleges, and is about to start a tenure-track job at Cal State LA. And he has given some good talks on the different layers of reductionism in molecular dynamics. They have models at varying levels of sophistication and detail for the different amino acids in a protein. They have a very complicated potential energy function that they use to calculate forces. It includes stretching of bonds, the bond lengths are in here. It includes rotation of bonds along different axes. And then it includes interactions that can be treated at anything from a Leonard Jones potential to considering the polarizations of the bonds. And they can decide how they're going to sample reaction coordinates, which is a fancy word for, it's not necessarily a physical coordinate, it's just how far along something is in a change of shape or relative position. And in all of those styles of theory, you get out things that look like this. They basically do long simulations that lend themselves to beautiful animations that I'm not going to show, where you see some sort of complicated ball and stick model of, say, a protein interacting with lipids. And these are all balls and sticks that are wiggling around. And it is actually a model that is very conducive to undergraduate participation because it's completely visual. As long as there's somebody who really knows the physical chemistry of it to sort of vet what sorts of systems the undergrad will explore and what they won't explore, it's actually a very good model for undergraduate participation. Yes?
You're saying ball and stick. Are they classical?
This is completely classical. There's no quantum chemistry in here. They are treating, usually they're treating the interactions via a Leonard Jones potential combined with electrostatics, if they have some knowledge of the ionization of the different groups on the amino acids. Yes?
How does CG stand?
Coarse-grained. This is where they aren't considering things like the polarization of the bond, the polarizability of the chemical bonds. Yes?
And there's only two bond interactions.
Correct. So a three-body effect would come up if you were to, say, consider here. He has a table of the different layers of assumptions that one can make. It would depend. I mean, you could say do all atom, where instead of modeling an amino acid where you just say, all right, here is A group. It is this. It is has this charge on it. It has this Leonard Jones. It has this coefficient in the Leonard Jones potential. If you were to actually consider the details of the bonds, but still on the classical level, then a three-body effect really comes up where one object comes in, changes the polarization of this bond, which in turn changes how this bond now interacts with a third object. So you do that still via pairwise interactions. The three-body effects are emergent.
So this is interactions. These are interactions between the constituent atoms or particles in your system. What about with the medium? Because a lot of biology is done in.
That's also included.
It is included in.
Yeah.
That.
You can do explicit solvents or implicit solvents, and it's not something that I do. It's just something that I see, and I'm giving. I see at a lot of conferences, so I'm giving the overview. But exactly how detailed their model of the medium is, you'll have to ask Paul or someone else doing MD.
So they've gone beyond a mean field type of generic, right? They're way beyond that, presumably, right?
Yes, they can be. Depends on what they want to do. Other questions? Usually you don't visualize the medium, though. You visualize the protein in the solvent. All right, let me.
Did I put something in the terminology umbrella? Why is it quote?
Because they're deciding which regions of parameter space, of configuration space, they want to sample. And so they impose an extra potential that has a minimum here. And so it basically selects out a region of configuration space to focus on. They sample, they primarily sample one part of configuration space. And there's a lot of sophistication and a lot of statistical mechanics that really goes into their sampling method, and knowing that when we, you know, if they want to look at two proteins interacting with each other, if they start off far enough apart, then on the ensemble of all possible trajectories, well, they could easily just happen to undergo a Brownian walk where they never even get close. They don't want that, so they have to select for things where they come close.
What's that have to do with umbrellas?
I think it's just because an umbrella casts basically a shadow over the person, and so they're putting in a potential that casts a shadow over one part of configuration space.
Okay. I did.
All right. For the last talk, I'm not going to get as far as I was hoping. I'm going to call this phenomenology and information limits. It's not just about predicting particular, you know, the outcomes of particular interactions. It's about predicting what will happen when the outcomes of those interactions take place and get measured in a messy, noisy environment and are looked at by tools of very finite precision. Nature was not nice enough to make the cell's interesting parts be visible to optical microscopes. at least conventional optical microscopes. It's nature's, the most interesting parts of a cell are too small for that. So there's a whole cottage industry of people who work on subdiffusive random walks. And this is very much a fundamental topic in statistical physics. It's done by a lot of people in biophysics, publishing in biophysical journals as well as PhysRev, presenting at biophysics conferences, because beyond fundamental questions about memory and ergodicity and so forth, just trying to predict what sort of concentration profile will I see if molecules are subdiffusing away from a source? What sort of concentration profile will I see if they are subdiffusing and reacting with another species? And will I be able to tell the difference between that and a simple absorption model? These questions are highly non-trivial. Yeah?
What is subdiffusion?
Subdiffusion is a random walk where instead of the mean squared displacement being proportional to time, it's proportional to time to some power between 0 and 1. So R squared is proportional to T to the 1/2, let's say. That would be a type of subdiffusive random walk. And that basically happens in systems either with memory or with a hierarchy, a power law hierarchy of length scales. Like if you imagine diffusion on a fractal or a fractal network of pores, that can give you subdiffusion. Diffusion in a system with a hierarchy of compartment sizes, like the compartments inside many cells, that can give you subdiffusion. And so teasing out the difference, or diffusion in a system where your molecule can bind to something and then unbind, but the environment is very heterogeneous, so there's this wide range of binding efficiencies, which means this wide range of on and off times. That can give rise to subdiffusion. And then you can ask, well, how will we observe that? And looking at a concentration profile might not give you a good answer. And so there's a whole subfield of people who do calculations of, say, solutions to reaction diffusion equations in media with different properties to say, will we be able to tell the difference between that and simpler models? And the answer isn't always yes. This is something I barely understand, but there's a whole cottage industry of people who model single molecule experiments, and they take this very complicated molecular structure. All right, this very complicated protein structure with lots of pieces that can bend and associate with each other and dissociate. And they reduce this enormously complex configuration space to a couple of dimensions that they might not even have a good visualization for. It might not be as simple as this joint opening and closing, and that's your parameter, that's your reaction coordinate. But they will just ask questions like, if most of our motion was along one coordinate versus two, or two coordinates versus three, what will happen to these time traces of the signal? Because they've got basically fluorophores, two fluorescent molecules that can either be close to each other or far, causing it to turn on and off. And they are trying to monitor the fluctuations of fluorescence and relate that to some direction in what is maybe a very high dimensional configuration space and go from this model to the statistics of these fluctuations. And there is a very large family of unsolved problems there that people continue to work on. That's a little more challenging to give to undergrads, but you can do some things with simple random walk models as limiting cases and have them work on that. Or do something like give them a simple random walk model that you know is not going to be as complicated as what you're looking at, but still has a few twists for how it's going to affect it, a few twists in the experimental response and see, well, how different will that be from the sophisticated model that you're working on? And if the fluctuations aren't different enough, you have a problem. So there's a whole subfield of people who just work on, given the internal dynamics of this system that we can't directly visualize, what will be the statistics of the fluctuations in an experimental signal? In the last 10 minutes, I'm going to show you a little bit of what I work on, which is the theory of super resolution. Basically, since people have overcome the diffraction limit, since they can now use an optical microscope to look at things smaller than the wavelength of light, what I ask is, what is the limit that replaces it? And there are two families of techniques. I'll talk about the one that is currently more popular. If we just had two molecules fluorescing at the same time close to each other, all you'd see is this overlap of two blurs. But if only one of them is on, well, then we get a circular blur. We can find the center of that circle, and we can say, there's a molecule there. And later the other one is on, and we can find the center of that circle and say, there's a molecule there. And we can build up a quantitatively valid map. And so the sequence of events is you have fluorescent molecules that are blinking off and on. The circles, the large circles, are representing basically the blurry images forming around these molecules. Only three of the molecules are on, we get three localizations. Later, three others are on, we get three localizations. Then we get an overlap, and there are ways to handle that. And this was all known for a while. It's just that people thought it was a bug, not a feature. People knew the fluorescent molecules blink, and they saw this as a problem. We want reliable signals from our fluorescent molecules. But at some point in the early 2000s, people started thinking, no, we can pull information out of that. And then around 2006, there was a revolution, and they figured out how to make this work. Now, what limits you is noise and light detection. It's one thing to say, oh, I've got a circular image, I'll find the center. But what if I don't get a nice circular image? What if I get this? So I collect more photons, I get that. So I collect more photons, I get that. And you say, oh, well, just use that molecule. Just use the one that gives you 2,500 photons. Well, photochemistry is not susceptible to human whim. You don't get to say, oh, I'm just going to use the really bright one, because nature doesn't always give you the really bright one, or it doesn't always give you one that will be really bright in the chemical environment of the cell. So people have worked on ways to use software to look at these overlaps and pull out many positions at once. And they basically do it by fitting successive models. They start with the brightest part, put a molecule there. Then they start putting more molecules in less bright parts and playing around with where to put them. And I want to skip ahead to the punchline. What I did was I used percolation theory to address this problem. For those who don't know what percolation theory is, if you have graph paper, if we just have all of the lines on the graph paper filled in, you can follow a path from one side to the other. If you remove most of the lines, there is no path from one side to the other. And somewhere in the middle, at some fraction, you get a crossover, and you do have a path from one side to the other. And figuring out what fraction of the bonds need to be filled in is going to give you something called the percolation threshold. Now, I wasn't thinking, well, why are people interested in it? Porous materials, conductors, forest fires. You could think of a forest fire as basically being a problem of you have highly combustible areas and less highly combustible areas. And if all of the highly combustible areas are connected, then your fire quite literally spreads like wildfire. I was not thinking about biophysics. I was looking for a project that had nothing to do with biophysics or biophotonics because I wanted to do something completely different with my students. So we looked at this unusual family of three connected lattices, and we computed one of their percolation thresholds. It should have just been one little senior project. Then we found out there's a whole family. There wasn't just one lattice, there's a whole family, so we found all of their thresholds. Then we started doing things like making oxides, so putting two connected sites between three connected sites and looking at those percolation thresholds. We fit them to a conjecture about the relationship between coronation number and percolation threshold, and found that the conjecture holds. And what started off as one dinky little senior project turned into two papers. So I learned percolation theory, or at least I learned some percolation theory. I was thinking about imaging. I said, you know, if you've got all these overlapping molecules, well, if they're sparse, I can do single molecule fits. If they're densely activated, I have a percolation problem. And if I try to estimate this position, I need to know something about this one. So these two are coupled because there's an overlap. So now I need to know something about that one. And pretty soon, everything is coupled to everything else. And this looks like a continuum percolation problem. Instead of graph paper, you have overlapping circles. And people have studied continuum percolation. And what happens is, you could say, well, you know what, I'm not going to make this hard. I'm not going to try to estimate everything at once. I'm just going to pick out a region of interest. Well, that's not so easily done, because I've got photons overlapping from a molecule outside the window. Which means, if I try to estimate this and this, I've got some signal here to account for. If I don't account for this, then I get bias towards that position. And I can work out, we're really short on time, I'll just skip to the punchline. We can work out a maximum density of activated molecules. And what that maximum density depends on is some features of your point spread function of your imaging system. This beta is just basically a measure of how the light focuses. The numerical aperture, how wide your collecting lens is. The number of photons produced. The wavelength of light. A tolerance on what precision you're willing to accept. And the percolation threshold of whatever percolation model you're mapping onto. We don't have to assume uniform circles. The underlying geometry may be more complicated. And we were able to work out from this a prediction for the localization precision. All right? And we worked this out using a bunch of paper and pencil techniques mapping onto a percolation problem. So we looked at someone else's simulations, all right, where they just generated a whole bunch of simulated data and then fit models to it and saw how precise it was. And if we put in our prediction for maximum density of activated molecules and our prediction for localization precision at that density, we exactly overlap someone's Monte Carlo simulations. So we're in the process of writing that up. So that's the style of biophysics I do, and we've only got a couple minutes, so I'll end here. Yes, Richard.
That's a really lovely overview. Thank you for that. I'm wondering, given
the discussion of how you can involve undergraduates, what's your view of the opportunities for biophysics major in physics departments at undergraduate colleges, you know, developing that track? I know University of San Diego has done that and attracted a lot of students. Do you think that's something that small physics departments ought to be thinking about?
I think so. We are in the process of developing one ourselves. Leaving aside just the intellectual arguments just for a moment, one reason is that physics is traditionally a small major, biology is traditionally a big major. Small departments should be thinking about it if for no other reason than survival. Then I think that intellectually, biophysics is not just us sort of solving problems for biologists. There are genuinely fascinating physics frontiers to explore there. So I think that to remain relevant, we should be doing it. And just in terms of tapping that student population, we should be doing it. And there are ways to involve undergraduates in this research on both the theory and experiment side. So I don't see a downside.
Yeah, but how difficult is it to create that major?
How do you create that major? Well, first you have to decide what to carve out of the physics major. And that's a real problem, because you have to make room for biology. And, you know, I don't want to have a curriculum committee meeting right now because there were a lot of arguments over that. But you have to basically say, well, what is the core of what physicists bring? It's our quantitative training and our fundamental understanding. So you don't sacrifice the quantitative training. You don't sacrifice the laboratory methods. We have a totally different laboratory culture than biologists. And ours isn't better or worse. It's just complementary. And that's why a lot of biology labs hire biophysicists. And then you say, all right, we're going to have to keep some fundamental subjects, but not all of them. And so you agree that you're going to keep StatMech, and you debate what else to keep or what else to allow students to choose from a menu of. And then you fill in the rest with biology. That was basically our discussion.
I mean, you had a couple of biophysics classes.
Biophysics is the hardest class to design because half the people in the room are scared of calculus and half the people in the room are scared of long words like phospholipid. It's the hardest class to teach. Absolutely the hardest class to teach. So we do have a biophysics class, but we look at the biophysics major less in terms of, well, we'll create these classes, and more in terms of we're going to have some students, and we're going to give them the best of what we have to offer, the quantitative methods, the lab methods, and some fundamental subjects, and then we're going to send them over to take the core of biology and the best that they have to offer, and they'll be cross-trained. We really looked at it from that angle, not the biophysics classes. Yes, Fred.
So there's maybe a different way of looking at this, is that using, you know, cannibalizing biophysics to sort of fertilize just the physics major per se. And so it looks like, you know, the research that you've done here, you know, it's combining sort of some optics analysis and some statistical physics. And so I'm just wondering, you know, in what sense have you sort of gone back to think about, well, it could just go into the traditional physics courses, or your experience of students taking traditional physics courses and then moving into, I didn't see, you had students working on the percolation, but did they also work on sort of this optical analysis as well?
Yeah, I didn't show it, but I have a large number of students who have worked on, say, Monte Carlo simulations of imaging. We simulate an imaging experiment in a messy condition, and then we apply different analysis techniques to the Monte Carlo data, to the Monte Carlo output, and ask, how much information can we extract? That's a big focus of what we do. And it's also something, although I didn't show it, it's something I do with a biology collaborator at City of Hope Cancer Research Hospital. You know, she says, all right, I think in my experiment, I can see this interaction. So then we do simulations of what sort of signal would you get from this interaction in the real noisy environment of her system with the real limitations of her instrument, and compare.
It does seem like that the last topic, though, that you're working on is the most removed from biology. Like, you would need, do the students need to know any biology at all to do that? It seems like it's zero, and it's all percolation and optics, and it just happens that it will fit this imaging environment.
It is certainly true for the day-to-day tasks. You don't need to know biology to do it. But in terms of the target application, the target audience, the people who actually apply this work or care about it, the people that you would see at any conference, the people who actually want to use this, then they're all biologists and biochemists and so forth. So even though it is very, very physics-y, the only conferences that I would really go to for this are conferences of biologists. And the people I would collaborate with to use it are biologists.
So I have a question and maybe a proposed answer. The question is, sounds like me, right? Beyond the diffraction limit,
yeah.
What is the limit to resolution? And the proposed answer is, in the case of fluorophores, part of the limit can be percolation if the density is high enough.
So the limit to resolution is now twofold. You could ask just, what is the smallest thing we can resolve? It's the wavelength of light over the square root of the number of photons. But then what comes in here is resolve in what time. And the answer for time is resolve in a time such that you're never activating more molecules than would produce a percolating cluster of images. Once you produce a percolating cluster of images, yeah. Maybe I should turn it over to Courtney now.
There's a footnote to that question. It was from A.R. Small at TUI3 in KITP. That's you.
All right. Thank you.